A poll was taken in 1902 asking people to select female candidates to be in the Hall of Fame of Great Americans. Margaret Fuller received more votes than Louisa May Alcott, Abigail Adams, Betsy Ross, and Pocahontas. If a poll were taken today asking the general public to name famous or influential 19th century Americans, I wonder if Margaret Fuller would even make the list. I hope so. I hope a woman of her intellect and her accomplishments will always be remembered. I do my best. I've preached on Margaret Fuller more than any other major figure in Unitarian history because to me, she is the most fascinating. And now this new biography by Megan Marshall gives me yet another reason to preach on Margaret one more time. I am convinced that if she had lived at a time when women had a real voice or real opportunities for education or employment, she might well have eclipsed Emerson as the most famous American transcendentalist. So who was this woman, once so famous and now so little known? Margaret Fuller was a writer, scholar, translator, literary critic, editor, journalist, reformer, outspoken advocate of women's rights, and according to her own assessment, the smartest person in the country. As she once said publicly, "I now know all the people worth knowing in America, and I find no intellect comparable to my own." So self-effacing and demure, she was not. You may guess that Margaret did not fit the prevailing norm for women at the time. She did not have a discreet, modest, or unassuming deportment, nor did she ever learn to speak what was called the special language of politeness and compliance that was expected of women of the day. She was whip-smart and assertive, and she spoke her mind about everything, including subjects as controversial as the disadvantages she cited women suffered by marrying, and she was particularly articulate in addressing all other kinds of injustices, especially those stemming from gender inequality. And although it's true there were no opportunities for women to have a real education, Margaret's father, a lawyer and a congressman from this state, believed that children learned moral development through education. And since Margaret was the oldest child, as our reading indicated, she was also the recipient of his most relentless ambitions. He began tutoring her daily in math, grammar, history, and classical languages when she was just 4 years old. And looking back on her rigorous homeschooling, Margaret said of her father, "He hoped to make me heir of all he knew." By the time she was a young teen, she was fluent in several languages and beginning to wonder if, in her words, she would ever be at home on earth. As an older teen, when she reached the all-important age of coming out into society, both her parents urged her to be more feminine, but it was too late. She had been trained to be a scholar, and she would never comfortably fit in the feminine subculture of the female world. One biographer writes, "In the face of a confusion of messages, Margaret read her parents' anxiety over her looks and deportment as a sign of failure that no exercise of mind could overcome. Only by continuing to excel intellectually could she fulfill at least one of her father's requirements, and thus she took to flaunting her ready wit. I made up my mind," she wrote, "to be smart and ugly." And yet, despite that outward bravado, like everyone, she too longed for intimacy, affection, and love. And there were relationships with men her age, most often consisting of an exchange of flowery letters, but more than once she also had her heart broken as someone she thought of as a suitor turned and married someone else. There were, as we know, few ways women could support themselves in the early 19th century: tutor, nanny. And although Margaret would try her hand at doing both, she dreamed of being an American George Sand or a Madame de Stael. But Boston was not Paris. Still isn't. And in Margaret's day, America had no place for female intellectuals. And then her father died, and his unexpected death forced her at age 25 into the role of breadwinner for her mother and younger siblings. So reluctantly, she turned to teaching again, and she wrote, and through her writing actually began to chip away at convention. But money for Margaret would be a lifelong struggle. Yet before long, she was invited by a group of Unitarian ministers to edit their new literary journal called The Dial, and eventually she would publish 5 books of her own. She hoped to be Goethe's American biographer and asked James Freeman Clarke to borrow his 40 volumes of Goethe's works in German, and it was years before she finally gave up on this project as too overwhelmingly time-consuming. Meanwhile, she had begun a series of what's called Public Conversations for Women, which over its 5-year lifespan became a Boston institution. And the conversations were designed to encourage women to think and discuss ideas. Her goal was to encourage women to take themselves seriously. They considered questions such as, "What are we born to do?" Her life, however, was in stark contrast to the wealth of her childhood friend Mary Soley, who had married into the DeWolf family, the family we learned about last Sunday in Tom's sermon. When Mary invited Margaret to Bristol for an extended vacation, Margaret found herself chafing at conventional female conversation about clothes and decorating, and returned home aware of what she called the tiresome burdens of wealth. Her first book, and most well-known, was also her most controversial, Woman in the 19th Century. In it, she criticized marriage, saying it was not an equal partnership between two adults, but an institution that kept women in a subordinate position, turning them into overgrown children. This book was surprisingly well received, but those who looked for reasons to criticize her radical ideas, the book was a storehouse of ammunition. Her second book, Summer on the Lakes, was a memoir of her trip west, which exposed both the dehumanizing treatment of Native Americans and also the destruction of natural land. And for this book, Margaret was able to obtain permission to use the Harvard Library, which meant she was the first woman ever able to do that. Her biographer writes, "Thomas Higginson remembered her sitting day after day under the covert gaze of male students who had never before looked upon a woman reading within those sacred precincts." Her writing eventually caught the eye of Horace Greeley, editor of the New York Daily Tribune, who offered her a job as literary editor of his paper. And so now she had a forum to expand her writings to all kinds of issues, including prisons, opposition to the death penalty, circumstances leading to prostitution, criticism of the poorly run charitable institutions, and in fact, her direct appeals helped create the first halfway house for women being released from prison, which is still being used today. And then an amazing thing happened. Horace Greeley asked her to be the Tribune's foreign correspondent, and Margaret's lifelong dream of seeing Europe was about to be realized. However, job or no job, women could not travel alone. It just wasn't done. Not even Margaret could. So she joined a Quaker couple, Rebecca and Marcus Spring, who were planning a trip to France and England. While the Springs were ostensibly pleased to have Margaret join them, Rebecca wrote in her diary that she worried about Margaret's impulsiveness, her propensity for social blunders, and her romantic flights of fancy. The worry of romantic flights of fancy would turn out to have been a prescient worry, but more about that later. Initially, the trip was everything Margaret had ever dreamed it might be. Ralph Waldo Emerson gave her a letter of introduction calling Margaret our citizen of the world by special diploma, and that was enough to get her to meet many of Europe's literary figures of the day. One of those figures was a man named Adam Mickiewicz, who was a revolutionary poet who urged Margaret not to just write about the full life women might have, but to actually live such a life. Live the life of liberty in masculine and frank style, he urged her. That sentence is in every one of Margaret's biographies, and each time I read it, I think how wrong it was that he didn't take into consideration that Margaret Fuller was not from an open society or open-minded country like France, but from here, from Puritan America and New England at that, and that one day she would have to return home. Indirectly, and within just a few years, this advice would cost her her life. But meanwhile, she traveled and wrote articles for the paper on the reforms needed from unchecked industrialism she saw in Europe, and she wrote editorials critical of America's unwillingness to live up to its own ideals. This from her column at home and abroad. My country is at present spoiled by prosperity, stupid with the lust of gain, soiled by crime in its perpetuation of slavery, shamed by an unjust war, and the aims of politicians selfish and petty. That was written in 1847. When she and the Springs moved south to Rome, Margaret announced that she would stay and live the life of an expatriate. Her plan was to write a history of Italy and to cover the impending Italian Revolution for the Tribune. But before long, the most compelling reason keeping Margaret in Rome was a young man named Giovanni Asoli. He was a nobleman, but he was from an impoverished family. He was not educated, and he did not speak English, and he was considerably younger than Margaret, but he loved her without reservation. And it was good he did, because at age 37, Margaret Fuller, known for having advocated the single life of honorable celibacy, found herself unmarried, pregnant, and very far from home. Among many factors complicating their relationship was the fact that Giovanni's family worked in the papal service in Rome and had for years, and in order for him to marry a Protestant, he would need papal dispensation, something he knew his family would never consent to his requesting. And so Margaret moved alone to a small village about 70 miles north of Rome for her time of confinement. She didn't dare tell her own family about the pregnancy, and now, not being able to work, she had little or no money and was often forced to depend on the charity of friends. Fortunately, Giovanni was able to be with her for the birth of their son, but they agreed that at least for the time, it was best to keep his birth a secret. And so reluctantly, they left their baby with a village family, and they returned to Rome, Margaret to the paper and the revolution, and at one point she even took on the responsibility as director of a field hospital. But the revolution was ending in failure, and foreigners were urged to leave the city. She and Giovanni returned to the village to claim their baby and made plans to move to Florence until Margaret could save enough money for the three of them to sail home to Boston. In a letter to a friend, Margaret wrote, "I am prepared when I arrive home to expect everything that is painful and difficult." How would her family, her transcendentalist colleagues, her friends receive Giovanni? And how would she support them? And how could she resume her reputation in Strait Lakes, Boston? These were the worries that consumed her, and yet her months in Florence, now that they were united as a family, were the happiest of her life. Just before they were scheduled to sail home, Margaret received a packet of mail. It included letters from her brother, Emerson, and her travel companion, Rebecca Spring, who wrote, "Much as we would love to see you, your friends believe it would be undesirable for you to return home at present." But it was too late. They had already booked passage. The ship she intended to take, the Argo, was shipwrecked on a return voyage back from the United States to France, and just that week she had read of another wreck by the English royal steamer, the Royal Adelaide. It seems, she writes, that safety is not to be found on the sea. "I shall embark in my merchant ship, praying fervently indeed that it may not be my lot to lose my baby at sea, either by sickness or amid the howling waves." The trip took almost a month, and the ship was due to land in Sandy Hook, New Jersey, but an inexperienced first mate, not realizing they were off course, mistook the lighthouse at Fire Island for their destination. Both passengers and crew went to bed that evening expecting to sail into New York Harbor the next morning, but a terrible storm in the night drove the ship into a sandbar, and with a resounding crash, it slowly began to come apart. And when dawn came, they realized they were only about 400 yards off the shore, and they could even see people on the beach who had come down to try to help, but the winds were strong and the surf was rough. Some passengers jumped in the waves and made it to shore, but Margaret was always terrified of water. 5 crew members stayed loyally with her and Giovanni, and finally the ship's carpenter took their baby and jumped into the swirling water, and minutes later a wave broke and the ship went down. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, a friend and admirer of Margaret's, said, when she learned of the drowning, "Margaret is indeed better off dead." Her old friend, Unitarian minister James Freeman Clark, also said, "It was manifest that Margaret not come back to struggle against poverty, misrepresentation, and perhaps alienated friendships and chilled affections." And Emerson, in his eulogy, said of her, "To the last, her country proves inhospitable to her. If nature availed in America to give birth to many such as she, freedom and honor and letters and art too would be safe in the new world. But living in her world, not a world of real freedom, for Margaret Fuller, it was not to be." Today we remember her, a Unitarian foremother, in gratitude, as we remember all who defy convention working for human dignity and freedom everywhere. I want to close with my very favorite Margaret Fuller quotation, which I have a framed copy hanging in my office. She writes, "It is true that a woman may be in love with a woman and a man be in love with a man. It is pleasant to think of it, for to be sure, it is the same love we will all feel when we are angels." So may it be.